Good evening, welcome to Dialect for the Sunday the 28th of March. This week we have a look at community radio in Thornbury and Cardiff with Helen Harrison and Jenny Savage. Artist Ralph Hoyt is here to talk about his sound art installation, and eagle-eared listeners will recognise the theme of land privatisation from previous shows. We return to the subject with Tony Gosling. Was the real reason King Charles I was executed in 1649 land privatisation? Was it a major cause of the English Civil War? Plus all the regular features. We've got the What's On with Jeff Sparks, and we've got another edition of Malcolm Grieve reading Hedge Trimmings. We'd like to start the week with Helen Harrison, who's here to talk about community radio in Thornbury. Hello.
Hello.
So how long have you been contributing towards Thornbury FM?
Thornbury FM is about to go into its ninth broadcast. We do two broadcasts a year of a month at a time, so I guess that makes it 4 years that we've been doing it. But we've actually just changed our name to Gloss FM.
Okay, so you're on like 24 hours a day for a month, is that how it works?
The way it works is we have 2 one-month periods with it's the Stig does from midnight till 7 in the morning, and then the rest of the time it's live people doing live shows.
Right.
And that's how it works. And we've just changed our name because we've got a bigger mast, so we can reach further than just Thornbury, so we can get right across to Yate and Bradley Stoke and up to Barclay and across the river to Chepstow, and
right,
okay. So much bigger reach than just Thornbury, so we wanted a name that kind of went bigger than that.
So is the content going to be become a little bit more ambitious possibly now that you've got an even bigger area?
A little more ambitious and a little more far-reaching, in that obviously there'll be a lot more community events that are feeding into it. We're not just looking at the community events of Thornbury, we're looking at the community events of all the listeners in all sorts of areas. So it's reaching out to all those people. But still very much the presenters are all local and have got a local bias to what they're doing.
I assume you must listen a little bit to other varieties of local radio. I mean, I don't know, maybe not the competition as such, maybe not quite in that spirit, but what do you think of the other radio services that the Bristol people have to offer?
I think they're very good. I mean, obviously, being out in Thornbury, I can't get hold of a lot of them because they're much more local, and so I can't always pick them up.
Okay.
But the ones that I hear when I come into Bristol, I think it's great having such a rich variety of different sorts of shows that are available for people. And I think that's what community radio is about. It's having the variety, but also having it something that's really grounded in the local community.
Mm.
So it's not something that could easily be national radio, but it's actually something that talks about what's, you know, at the heart of the community.
Yeah. So what do you think, besides, sort of issues local to Thornbury, that you could provide possibly mainstream broadcasters can't do as such? Not necessarily don't do, but what do you think? Something like BBC Radio Bristol or something, you know, what is it you can do that they can't?
I think you can probably be a little cheekier than they can. You don't need to toe the party line quite so much.
Right, fair enough.
So that's one area. We can have young people broadcasting on our show. So, you know, we have sort of 13, 14-year-olds doing some of the broadcasts on our shows, which obviously you're not going to get on BBC Radio. Because everyone's a volunteer, I think that brings an extra dimension to it, rather than it all being very sort of formal and having to fit in with something that fits into the national way of doing things.
Yeah. I mean, I assume you don't really know how many people listen to your show.
It's very hard to know how many people listen, yes.
Does that matter?
No, I mean, sometimes I sit there broadcasting and think, actually, you know, I might just be speaking to myself, but I have a great time. And actually, you know, some people do listen. We've got, because we broadcast over the web as well, we can tell from the number of hits how many people are listening via the web.
Mm.
But yeah, when we go during the 1 month and it's live over the airwaves, it's very hard to tell, except by asking people in the streets.
Okay.
And also by feedback that you get, you know, people emailing in, phoning in, and that sort of feedback as well.
Right. How much does it cost to put all this together? Because radio, you know, equipment could be an expensive business. How have you put all this together?
We got some funding from various small grant making bodies. I have no idea exactly how much it costs, and if I knew I was going to be asked that question, I'd have found out beforehand.
That's all right.
So I can't tell exactly, but yeah, it's a lot of sponsorship and advertising, so local businesses get involved and want to sort of promote what they're doing as well.
Okay. How reliable do you find volunteers are, as do you think?
I think they're very reliable, actually, because they do it because they want to be doing it, and they just love it and come along and do their job.
Yeah. What do you attracts you to radio specifically? You know, as you could have volunteered for anything, but what is it you love about radio? What does it offer?
It's my 5 minutes of stardom.
Well, with that in mind, when are you actually on?
We start again on April the 19th, 87.7 FM.
Okay.
And it runs for the 4 week period. So. Okay. 24 hours a day.
87.7 FM. An important question, can people in Bristol with your lovely huge mast pick you up?
Not right the way down here, they won't be able to, but if you go onto Gloss FM, you can listen via the website. Anyone can listen via the website. If you're wanting to listen on your, tune in on your radio, you'd have to be north side of Bristol to be able to pick us up.
Okay. Well, with all that in mind, what is your website? Where can people get in touch with you on the web?
Yep,
to listen?
It's www.glossfm, that's glossfm.org.uk.
.org.uk, yep. There you go, .org.uk. So touching briefly on a completely foreign subject, just before we disappear, I understand you're off to Mozambique soon. Tell me a little bit about
yes.
that. Yes, this is a
trip that, with a completely different hat on, putting together. It's October 23rd till November the 8th, November the 3rd, going out to Beira, which is linked with Bristol City, and we're going to have some time in Beira working with some of the projects Bristol is linked with, and then going up to Nampula, which is where the fair trade producers are.
Okay.
And that links in with Bristol being a fair trade city.
Okay.
So if anyone wants to come along on that, then...
Yep.
Probably easiest is to contact the radio station, and they can put them in contact with me.
Okay, so that channels back to your website, which is Gloss, GLOSSFM,
.org.uk.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for coming in, Helen Harrison, and best of luck with your new broadcasting period.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Artist Ralph Hoyt is here in the studio, and he's here to talk about what I initially advertised as sound art installation, but it turns out there's an awful lot more to it than you would have thought at first. Hello.
Hi.
So whereabouts are you from in Bristol?
I'm Bishopston based,
okay.
just up the road, 5 minutes on the bike, in the wet.
Yeah, in the wet.
Yes.
So tell me a little bit about sound art installation, or not. What exactly is it?
Well, I think, sound art installation is perhaps a misnomer. I'm a poet, writer, and I have an artist, and I have an increasing interest in emerging media. And one of the most interesting new forms of media is mobile media, basically, because media are becoming ever more personal. Mm. And ever more bound to location. So, for example, what I can do is using this technology, which is called pervasive media,
right.
is I can use satellites, up to 7 satellites, which I believe are American military satellites. It's a GPS-controlled system. The satellites know where you are, so they can send a signal to that point. For example, if you were, let's say, in that corner of Queen Square...
Okay.
I would write, I wrote a play called 1831 Riot in 2004, which mm-hmm. was the world's first located audio play in an intelligent environment. What that means is the media know where you are, so content on your device, on your GPS device, can be triggered by a satellite signal. So if you're in one part of Queen Square, you get one signal. If you're in another part of Queen Square, you get another signal.
Okay.
And those signals can be audio or video.
Okay, so what sort of devices are we talking about? Is this a sort of device we already have, or you get supplied?
Well, at the moment, they're fairly scarce on the ground. Up to now, pervasive media has been written for Hewlett-Packard iPack, it's called, which is a sort of portable PDS. but it's being rewritten potentially for platforms such as the iPhone.
Okay.
So we hope to be able to offer the piece of work I'm working on at the moment, which is called The Froom Maidens. Mm-hmm. We hope to be able to offer that on an iPhone platform as an app.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about the artistic vision for The Froom Maidens, because The Froom is what, Somerset?
The Froom is right next door. In fact, it probably flows underneath here or into here when it's really wet. No, the Froom, of course, is the reason Bristol is here, because Bristol was founded at the confluence of the Froom and the Avon. Mm-hmm. And in Saxon times, the Froom actually joined the Avon right outside the door in Welshback.
Okay.
That's why Bristol Bridge is where it is. That's why Bristol Castle is where it is. It was an easily defendable position. In 1240, the Froom was diverted to where it is now, so it runs past the watershed. But it's 18 miles long. It arises somewhere very near Old Sodbury, so it's quite a short river.
Okay.
And the reason for the Froom Maidens is, well, you know, I figured the Rhine has Rhine Maidens, so why shouldn't the Froom have Froom Maidens?
Right.
So the conceit is that the poetical conceit, and this is just as a poet, this work is based on a long poem the theme of the Froom Maidens.
Okay, I mean, when I say Rhine Maidens, I'm kind of thinking Wagnerian spectacle. Is that kind of your angle?
Not really. These Froom Maidens are called Kylie, Katie and Brittany.
Okay.
And, they go down, they go clubbing on Saturday night, you know. But behind them, there are those Wagnerian archetypes, yes, and behind them, even older archetypes, you know, the three fates. And then there's all the stories about water nymphs and spirits of the water. So the Froom Maidens are guardians of the Froom. And in fact, to be quite, as a poet, the main thing a poet does is listen. So I spend a lot of time listening to what these Froom Maidens could have to say about the Froom being culverted for most of its length in Bristol.
So how, specifically, is this also to be sort of located for media in an intelligent environment?
Yes.
How specifically would that work in the context of people walking around Bristol?
It'll be people walking along the Froom walkway. Mm-hmm. So we'll choose 5-6 sites alongside the Froom, and we'll locate the GPS-triggered piece along there. Also, I'm not working alone. I'm working with a very contemporary composer called Mark Yates and a coder programmer called Phil Phelps. Right. So the three of us are working on it together.
Okay. How the dickens do you get 7 US military satellites to broadcast your work, might I ask? How do you go about this?
SatNav, that's how SatNav in cars works. Yeah. They're using the same satellite network.
Okay.
So it's and GPS walkers use the same system.
Okay.
And the military will allow you to use it to a certain degree of specificity, but not beyond that.
Okay. Do they sort of look at what you're actually going to be using their satellites to broadcast at all? Did you have to sort of send
it? I have no idea what they think of it. I haven't asked them.
So when is, what was your timescale for this? How long?
June.
In June.
We hope to have it finished by June.
Where can people find out more about this?
Usually through the Pervasive Media Studio, which is based over the Firehouse Rotisserie, part of the Watershed, part of iShed.
Okay.
Be able to find out at the moment through the Pervasive Media Studio. And if you Google PM Studio or Pervasive Media Studio, you can find out what Pervasive Media means.
Okay, brilliant. Well, Ralph Hoyt, thank you very much for coming in and talking. That was absolutely fascinating, and we look forward to it.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, continuing with the theme of writing plays, I have a playwriter, an author with me now, Chris Adams from the Kelvin Plays. Hello.
Hello.
Tell me a little about the Kelvin Players. Where are they based? What are they?
It's based in Bishopston in Gloucester Road. There's a converted Methodist church which we use and turned into our own studio theatre, with all the facilities we need. It's just on Pigsty Hill. Does everybody know Pigsty Hill on It's the local name for that bit of Gloucester Road which suddenly goes steep towards the top of, as Bishopston goes into Horfield.
Okay, yep.
Okay. It's the theatre's there. It's, as I say, it's an old Methodist church.
Okay. What sort of plays do you do? I mean, sort of comedies, tragedies, all sorts of
things. Well, Cavern Players does a whole variety of things. They do six productions a year. They've just done Brimstone and Treacle by Dennis Potter. They're doing a pantomime next year. In February. They're Pillar Man, which is quite a heavy play. I forget who wrote it, but it's is the next production coming up. Yeah. And after that, there's a play about Vincent van Gogh in London when he lived in Bristol for a short time.
Right. Okay. What sort of attendances do you get?
Well, pretty good if we in the Studio Theatre, because we can only seat about 80 people, and we can usually fill it most nights.
Okay. Brilliant.
In the past, we haven't done this for some time. We used to go to places like the Redgrave Theatre and the QEH Theatre. Yeah. You know, hire them. Those we did find difficult to fill, and they also cost quite a lot of money. So,
okay. I mean, how do you feel you fit in with you know, the other artistic sort of plays going on around in town? You know, the Old Vic and places like that.
I don't really know what you mean by fit in. I mean, yeah, we do similar sorts of things, and maybe sometimes we're a bit more adventurous, you know, in what we do.
Okay, that's interesting. So you feel the Old Vic can be a little conservative? Do you think they go for the crowd pullers, do you think?
Well, they could be. I mean, if your living depends upon it, you know, you have to be a bit careful, I suppose, don't you?
Okay, that's interesting.
You have to get bums on seats. Although we have to survive, the Kelvin Players has to, when we get no funding, I mean, we have to survive on what we take in ticket money.
Right.
And also letting, the hall is let out, you know, to dance troupes and things, you know.
Okay, so I understand you've written you write plays, but specifically you've written something at the moment. What have you written?
Yeah, I wrote a play called Cut, a one-act play, which is was done at the Bristol One-Act Play Festival and the Avon One-Act Play Festival.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't actually win the Bristol, but we did well enough to go on to the next round. It starts off as a local festival, and it's done all over the country, and then it feeds into the next round, which is a sort of district.
Okay, so
and then it goes up to area, and then eventually to an English final, and then eventually to a British final.
Okay,
so we've got through the first stage. We're now onto the district.
Now onto the district areas.
Well, this has been done in Ilminster, so anywhere between here and Ilminster, I suppose, that sort of area that it covers.
I suppose that must give you to wonder how many playwrights there are between here and Ilminster that you might be competing with right now.
I know the ones in Bristol because, I've done other one-act plays before, so and we tend to meet each other, you know, at these things.
You write play. What else have you written? Are you an author generally? Have you tried writing sort of many things and you set them in plays?
Yeah, I've always been. I used to write for Play School, actually, you know, on television, on Play School and Play Away. I used to do songs and sketches for Brian Cant and all those people. But then I went on to... I've written lots of musicals for children to perform, some of which are still being done.
Right. What is Cut about? Tell me about that. What's the subject?
It's a bit weird, really, a bit off the wall. It's a man's on his way to work, an accountant, and suddenly he finds himself in a situation where everybody around him seems to believe he's in a film, that he's starring in a film. But as far as he knows, he's never been an actor, and he just gets more and more distraught as they try and, you know, get him to be an actor.
Yeah.
And eventually, and he runs into what he thinks is his first wife, but she doesn't recognise him, and then eventually he has a breakdown.
Okay.
And then the plot twists, and it twists a couple of times, and I can't really tell you how it twists, because...
That would be giving too much away, wouldn't it? Of course. So what sort of skill set do you need when you're writing plays? I mean, like, you know, you assume it's just all dialogue. I mean, where do you start with that? And what else do you need to... How do you need to plan it out?
Well, you have to have the way I do it, I just have a sense of what is the audience seeing and what are they hearing, and, you know, are they involved? And if I did that, might I lose the audience? So perhaps I, you know, ought to do it differently. And it's just experience you build up over the years, I suppose, what you think will work, you know, what...
I mean, when you say sort of the Old Vic tend to be possibly slightly less adventurous, so what do you think of modern TV drama? I mean, we always used to have sort of Play for the Day and stuff like that, and, you know, all sorts of stuff going on. What do you think of the stuff going on now?
No, I'm not particularly impressed. I'm a bit of a Cops and Robbers fan. I do like sort of, you know, detective things, you know, all the detective ones. But I must admit, they seem to run out of steam about three parts of the way through. That they don't seem to keep up the tension.
Yeah.
But there have been some really good things on it. I mean, things like Wallander I particularly enjoy, but which is a bit bleak, but I... Yeah, there's not a lot of good stuff. You have to watch a lot of television before you see. I find something which really moves me, appeals to me. I want to be emotionally involved in something, you know,
to
enjoy it.
Which
is when I write, which is what I try and do, is involve the audience emotionally.
Okay, so where can people see? Cuts if they want to go see it. Where can people find
out? Unfortunately, at the moment, only in Ilminster.
Only in Ilminster, okay. So where can people find out about the Kelvin Players?
If you just Google Kelvin Players, it comes up with the website with all their productions. And,
okay, so that's K-E-L-V-I-N, Kelvin Players. And your name is Chris Adams. Yeah. Are you on the internet as well?
Yeah, I've got a website, mainly with my musical plays for children, which... are still selling sometimes.
Okay.
That's www.youngsong-adams.com.
Okay, excellent. So tell me a little bit. You said that you wrote plays for kids in your earlier days. Tell me a little bit about more for that.
Well, I started off, it was something which, it was a development of writing for television, you know, for play, because I was writing for children there. And I'd always been interested in the theatre. So one of the first I wrote was a play called The Evacuees, which was about children being evacuated in 1939, or 41, whatever it was. And I just wrote a musical around that.
How did you break down such a complicated subject, and what age range were you doing it to?
You do it to any age range, but the people in it are up to 12, really.
Okay, right.
Okay. It's for junior schools. Junior schools tend to do them. They can be, and middle schools, and you know, the lower part of secondary schools. That is the Evacuees is the one which has been my most popular one over the years. But I got onto the Factory Act in 1833, so I wrote a play around that called The Factory Children. Which, okay. Again, it's all children.
So he's trying to organise kids for a play, like trying to herd cats. Sounds like some right.
I don't do that very often. I just watch somebody else do it. I write it, and then I've got a young daughter who's still at junior school, and I've played for their productions of things, and I'm amazed how they organise these kids. I couldn't do it. I just write the words of the songs.
So that's an ongoing sort of interest. He's still doing that now.
No, I haven't written this switching to adult drama, if you like, it's happened fairly late in my life. It suddenly happened to me. I suddenly found myself.
Did you find that more of a challenge or less of a challenge?
Well, it's more of a challenge as much. It's slightly different, actually. You were saying about how you write a play. I mean, if I write something like the Factory Children, you start off with the history, and you work out how you compare the history down to fit in. You know, to a two-hour play. But the adult plays I write, I just wait for something to come to me.
Okay, so if you were to try and give advice to somebody, say, I want to try and write a play, and I'm thinking, where the heck do I start?
Just write, that's all. Just keep writing.
Just keep writing.
Just keep writing the dialogue, try and get people to do it, see if it works. If it doesn't, see why it doesn't work, and, you know, write it again. And you just keep doing it, really, that's all.
Okay, and just remind us of your website once again.
My personal website is youngsong-adams.com.
Brilliant. And, of course, you can always stick Kelvin Players into your favoured search engine and find out more on what they're doing next. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Well, it's now time to be transported to a bucolic Arcadian fantasy of the countryside with Hedge Trimmings, read by Malcolm Greaves.
Hedge Trimmings by A.G. Street. Very idle thoughts continue. You know, I feel a lot better now that I have told you about that dream. Up to date, I don't seem to have taken enough advantage of the general title of these talks. I haven't been idle enough. When I get up here, all the idleness in me disappears. I feel overwhelmed at the idea that I am talking to thousands of listeners, and consequently I find myself talking seriously and sedately, so as to offend nobody, whereby I dare say I pleased very few. Some of my farming friends have taken me to task over these talks. They tell me that I have missed the bus completely. "You ought to tell them now you've got the chance," they say to me. "Tell them what?" I ask. "Why, about all the hard times we're suffering. Tell them how we're losing money, that it ought to be stopped." "Give them facts and figures," says another. "Tell them how much Russian wheat was dumped here in the last quarter." Yet another wants technical details of farming, and another yearns for pungent political argument. And the general opinion amongst my farming friends is that I have let them down badly over these talks, and that I have missed a grand chance to tell you all these things. But there are three reasons, it seems to me, why to have done as they suggest would have been unwise. One is that I have no authority to talk on scientific or technical agriculture, or on agricultural politics. I have no diplomas or certificates in the bottom of my trunk. I know a little about the farming in my immediate neighbourhood only, and I cannot claim any great personal success, even in my own farming, although I have managed to keep my head just above water in these difficult times, which is, perhaps, something. The second reason is that I don't think the average listener wants to be talked at or lectured. Anyway, not at 7:10 on a summer evening, and I have a notion that he wants to be entertained. Anyway, that has been my intention in these talks, and I hope that I have not altogether failed. It is true I have sandwiched in here and there a little information, because I have noticed that the oblique method sometimes succeeds where direct attack fails. But the third reason is that personally I dislike facts, statistics and economic theories. They are such beastly misleading things. One can prove or disprove anything by their aid. The whole world has been run by hard and fast economists of late years, and I cannot see that its present condition is any advertisement for this method. So I think that to talk to you of the economic reasons why farming should be made to pay would be a mistake. For one thing, there are numerous experts and politicians who have all the facts at their fingertips and could do it much better than I can. And for another, I know that were I, for instance, to prove by facts that bread should be dearer, someone else would be able to prove by the same means that it should actually come down in price. Then there is all this organisation business and legalised interference by the state in business matters. Farmers must be disciplined, organised, told what to grow, when to sell it, how to sell it, etc. It is a great game. Of course, everybody is glad to see the other fellow disciplined by Parliament, but I cannot see that it does much good. A is not doing well, so he squeals loud and long, and our legislators sit up late, trying to find a way to help him. Finally, some Act of Parliament is passed to make things better for him. When this is done, it is discovered that, in consequence, B, who was doing all right, is now in difficulties. Of course, B squeals. He says that it is not fair, and we are great on trying to make things fair by political means nowadays. We do not realise that nothing in life is fair, and never will be. However, something has to be done for poor B, so another act is passed to help him, which in its turn reacts on A, and there you are. It must be so. There's no hole where wealth can be dug up. Any artificial increase in A's wealth must come from somebody, to wit, our friend B. Of course, you may think that if these two acts have not done any good, they have not done any harm, for as they leave A and B relatively where they were before. But they have done harm, for you must not forget C and D, who now have a job at a good salary, to run around and see that A and B and everybody else obeys these two laws. Better far to leave A and B alone to work out their own salvation, and then, if A is a better man than B, he will get the reward for so being. But I am afraid that is much too old-fashioned a doctrine to preach over this up-to-date apparatus. Anyway, farming is the last industry that should be improved in its management by state interference. The weather interferes enough, God knows, without any other outside influence being given power to do so. Farming is not a thing which can be cut out of paper, so to speak. Two and two do not always make four. I have known them to make three or five. Actual practice differs largely from the directions in the book. Sometimes you obey all the rules and fail, while at others you may break all the rules and succeed. For instance, I've grown some fine turnips in this year in a very unorthodox manner. As I have told you, I farm nearly all grass, but I've got 3/4 of an acre of arable land where the men's potatoes and mine are placed. When this was done, there was about 40 rod left unplanted, and it was just left. I was too busy to bother with it. In June this got very weedy, so I told one of my men to plough it once more. This done, I gave him some turnip seed and told him to throw it in on the harrows while he was dressing down the fallows. The same evening he came to see me. "Thee't had to do summat up there," he said. "Why, Jim?" I asked. "'Tis main nubby. Tall had to be rolled." I have only a large tractor roller, and it was not worthwhile to send it nearly a mile to roll 40 rod, so I told him that we should have to chance it unrolled. "I tell 'ee, 'tis main nubby. Tall had to be rolled. Thee oughtn't get no turnips else." Of course, I knew he was right. That is the worst of these old friends. They always are right. I tried to wriggle out of doing this rolling, but it was no good. Main nubby was the burden of his song, and he seemed prepared to sing it continuously until I took his advice. But it was absurd to send the tractor and roller that distance for 5 minutes' work, and I wanted it for something else. Then I thought of a way out. "Take our lawn roller tomorrow morning, Jim. Tie it behind a cart and tow it up there. You can hitch your horse to it and roll that little bit before anyone will be about to see you." He ruminated for a few moments. "Oh, ah," he said. "Go and do a vile thing like that, and then thee talk about it on the wireless." And I have.
Thank you to the actor Malcolm Greaves from the heady metropolis of Swindon, reading another episode of Hedge Trimmings, and more next week.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, I've got a guy in the studio who's happened to drop by and seems quite an interesting guy, claiming he's bent on world domination, so thought we'd pop him in the hot seat for a chit-chat.
John, can I say something?
Yes.
Give me a high five! How you doing, John? You all right?
Yeah, I'm all right. Yeah, doing very well. Doing very well. Your name is Junior Saunders.
Junior Saunders, yes.
Okay, and how are you hell-bent on world domination?
Well, about 5-6 months ago, I started this. I had this vision, almost, this light bulb went off in my head that unsigned artists of all genres wasn't able to be put on a platform and shown musically what they could do. So I really wanted to do an unsigned chart show. Mm-hmm. Predominantly, I'd done a chart show, but it was very American influenced. And also, not only that, the premise was kind of like urban music.
Yeah.
I really wanted to kind of emphasize the fact that all genres of music have their particular beauties. So I went to management and I said, I really want to do an unsigned chart show. And they said, yes.
Okay, so who did you go to specifically?
Ujima.
Ujima, okay, Ujima, the local radio station. Yes. Excellent, right. So when are you going to be on?
Well, we're on every Sunday at 5 p.m.
Okay.
We've already had 2,000 people join our Facebook group in 5 weeks. And we've all, in 1 week, we had 600 emails for votes. So it's going. There's something within.
Definitely, right.
That is ready to kind
where'd you
of
get,
flow.
How'd you find out about unsigned acts? Because there are so many, the hundreds in Bristol. Where'd you start?
It was more or less sharing the same kind of passion as them. I think, you know, I work in television myself, so kind of almost getting there then getting knocked back. You need a platform where you can collate together and really show the world your true talent.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you put it out there, the branding's got to be 100%. And also, you know, if you've got the passion and the vision, I think people tend to really embrace you and they take it seriously. Even in your own mind, if you just think to yourself, okay, you know, I'm going to make this something it's not, but with the direction, it's going to be something anyway. Yeah. I think it can really work.
Tell me a little bit about Ujima then.
Ujima's a station which was set up 2 years ago. Actually, if you go back a couple of years, they was around before under a different frequency and a different name.
Yeah.
And then they kind of came back. And they're a community radio station predominantly for urban music. So they play jazz, hip-hop, soul, R&B. And they're just a radio station which is based in St. Paul's. And they do, brilliant shows, really.
Yeah, I'm reminded a little bit of John Peel, because he was always found lots of unsigned acts and used to do his Festive 50.
Yeah.
Did find some people would try and fix it a little bit and ring up and, you know, do too many votes. How do you know that isn't going to happen to you?
Well, I'll tell you the honest truth. I watched something about John Peel and it really inspired me to help unsigned artists. And really, there's two things from my show that I really want to do. Number one, I want to bring the John Peel vision into the 21st century.
Right.
Number two, I want to create the same revolution in the 90s, what Massive Attack, Tricky, Kashin, Ronnie Size did to the musical scene. Because I don't know if you know this, but Bristol was actually voted the number one musical city in the UK.
Yeah.
And London was 20.
Yeah, more people live here who get royalty payments from the Performing Rights Society than everywhere else in the UK.
There you go.
High concentration. Yeah.
Exactly. So I really kind of want to jump on that.
Yeah.
Because that's something to celebrate in all cultures. In all aspects of the Southwest, and it's not just Justin Lee Collins that should be known.
Oh God, you've mentioned that name. Oh, he's all right. Yeah.
No, he's a good guy, but yeah, I think he could be doing more for Bristol. I think everybody that's made it could be doing more for Bristol, really.
Yeah,
as a whole.
Yeah. Tony Robinson and Justin Lee Collins seem to be pretty much, what people know.
So. They're the front guys, but it's us. We're the new talent, John. We're gonna get out there and show the world what Bristol's made of.
Brilliant. I mean, what do you think of the amount of local music that a lot of local radio stations are or should be playing? I mean, there are a lot of local radio stations from BBC Radio Bristol down to Vibe and Galaxy.
They're too corporate. That is the honest truth. They are too corporate and they don't like to give unsigned artists the chance to really excel within their contingency.
Yeah.
I believe that they're just so brainwashed and they want to sound. I mean, there's a particular station in Bristol, I don't want to mention any names, but one of my bands, who I'm very passionate about, Diego, approached them, said to play their music. They said, oh, it's not rock. And their music is absolutely unbelievable. Same quality as Coldplay, easily.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't play them. So I think it's a lot to do with the individuals and they use the kind of...
Do you think local stations kind of hanker after being a national, the glory of being like a national radio station?
It's kind of like, you know, I'm BBC, so I must act a certain way, you know?
Right.
I think that really plays a lot to do with the whole picture. I think they're not individuals. I think they're just a corporation.
Okay.
And that really kills music in the sense of localising and bringing through talent.
Okay.
It's horrible.
So rather than play the Menshevik line and try and worm your way into the establishment and try and change things from the inside, you're just going to go Bolshevik and do your own.
Tell you something. First ever outside of Ujima, I'm about to say this. So this is exclusive to Dialect Radio.
Oh, yeah, come on, man. Yeah, yeah.
And that is one of our artists made it to number one for 4 weeks. A guy called Frenzy. Try and get him on the show. He's brilliant.
Okay.
He's got an absolutely unbelievable fan base. We had loads of emails, texts. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And what we're actually doing is we're doing a PA outside Kiss to get his single played once. Once.
Just the once.
Once. Just the once on Kiss.
Yeah.
Because their remix 4 to 6 million, whereas ours are in the region of 20 to 25,000 listeners.
Yeah.
So we really want to take that and see what we can do with it.
Yeah.
And he made it to number one for 4 weeks, so was really important as well.
Do you think that usual sort of, the old vision is like, there's this family tree, like if it's local, it gets big, it obviously just goes national and then, you know, just moves up. But with all this emerging media, like, do you think that sort of same hierarchy kind of still works?
Well, it's funny you say that, actually, because I was actually told by my good friend and producer, Linda Oliver, that internet radio is on the rise.
Yeah.
The death of analog is actually happening now.
Yeah.
So I think if everybody internationally knew about your brand and knew what you was exactly doing, and they took a liking or a reference to it, I think it could actually kill the analog radio, because the digital switchover in terms of putting all the radio stations on digital has actually not worked.
Yeah.
So people are not, it's not that relationship where, you know, you find it very personal. Mm-hmm. It's digital. I think it kills things a little bit. If you make it more flexible to you,
yeah,
then I think it could really work within your aura.
Okay, talking about Unsung Music, actually, also occurs to you. What do you think about Six Music going down?
Six Music going down? I listened to Six Music a lot. I did approach them once because there was a guy I used to work with called Fraser Boys who was absolutely unbelievable. He should have been on there. And they kind of just laughed at him and went, okay, we're not interested, and kind of switched off of them then, because I thought that he was right for the brand. But Six Music, I think they didn't open up enough. Mm. I think they had a residue where they could have done more,
yeah,
but they kept within the boundary. And that's why it's kind of just dying, because there's also a suspension of Asian Network as well.
Yeah.
That could also be going down. Yeah. I think it's having the BBC remit, but not allowing it to be its own. One Extra has just turned into a commercial station. And if you look at the premise of it before, it was a black station.
Yeah.
Where are you going? Who are you trying to appeal to? It gets lost. And when something gets lost, it just gets crushed, really. Okay. That's my perception.
Fair play. So tell me, Ujima. How do you spell Ujima? Just okay. So people don't
know. U-J-I-M-A. Swahili. I don't know what it means, but I know Swahili.
Okay, you said that like a rat. U-J-I-M-A. Okay, yeah. And where on the web can we find Ujima?
Okay, it's www.ujimaradio.com.
Ujimaradio.com. And Junior Saunders, when is your show on?
5 p.m. every Sunday.
5 p.m. every Sunday.
Yep.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Another high five?
Another high five.
There we go.
Nice one. Thank you.
The Orally Astute will have noticed a theme developing over the past few weeks with the privatisation of land and the Civil War and English history. Over the last few weeks, we've been hearing a lot about that. And all of that began with the enclosures system, which began with the Statue of Merton in 1235. Wow, this is pretty heavy stuff. So we've got Tony Gosling here, our bod on English history, who's here to explain it to us. This week, we'll look at the role of land privatisation played in the run-up to the English Civil War in the 1640s. Hello, Tony.
Hi, John.
Tell me a little bit about how you first sort of became really interested in this briefly.
Well, one of the reasons I think it's useful and actually important today still is because this whole idea of privatisation is going further and further and further. Back in the 1200s, when we were talking about it first started, the privatisation of land, mm-hmm. it was really thought to be something that nobody could own. The idea that you might own land was complete anathema.
Like the American Indians, for example.
Because obviously everybody needs to share it, you know, particularly if you're walking around in the country. Side, and it was a major, at least as far as I can see, it was a major reason why the English Civil War happened, because land privatisation was starting to accelerate in the run-up to the Civil War. Then there was the fight, and it kind of stopped for a little while. And afterwards, in the 100 years after the English Civil War, if you see, most of the land in Britain was then enclosed.
I mean, we're usually told this that Civil War is to do with ship taxes and Charles being incredibly stubborn and ungiving.
Well, that's right. I mean, this is the classic, sort of history book definition and history class O level A level thing. Mm. Is ship money was the reason, and this apparently was a tax which was levied on all the ships coming in and out of Britain by the king. And this ship money in the run-up to the Civil War also increased, but actually far more lucrative for the merchant classes who were becoming increasingly influential around the country was if they could privatise land, they then had quite a considerably increased income from agriculture. Mm-hmm. Now, there were some benefits to this, and it meant that the productivity of the land went up, but it meant also that there were far more people who had nowhere to live, because most of the land was covered with, you know, before the Civil War, was covered with people who were basically peasant farmers.
I mean, this presumably must have been quite a lengthy process, because Prince Charles, if I remember, was like
King
already
Charles.
On the throne for about... King Charles, sorry. Not Prince Charles. Was already on the front for about 25 years before the Civil War started, so we're talking quite a long period.
Well, it was all about trying to balance the books, a little bit like today, in a way.
Yeah.
But the money that the merchant classes were getting, these are the sort of new people from the City of London, were getting in the run-up to the Civil War, was a fantastic amount from privatising land. Mm-hmm. What they generally did was evicted people, and of course, let's not forget that this was a landowners' parliament. Only people who owned land could vote. And they, so they, as they evicted people, they then turned the land over to producing sheep, which needed hardly any labour and also brought in a much, much bigger return with the wool and the meat from the sheep.
Okay. So have we got a history of events building up to the Civil War where land privatisation was sort of a bone of contention?
Well, it was. And I've been looking through some of the accounts of enclosures over the year. One is a book called The English Village Community and the Enclosure Movements. This explains that from about 1607 to 1636, the government pursued an active anti-enclosure policy. Because what was happening was people were being destitute, left by the side of the road and this kind of thing, right around the country. And so eventually the word got through to the government, which in those days really was effectively the king. And he decided, look, if these people are going to be made destitute, then at least I'm going to make some money out of it. So he started fining all the landowners that were evicting peasants and started generating cash like that. Another quote from the same book says, if the reign in its social, that's the reign of Charles I, in its social and agrarian policy may be judged solely from the number of anti-enclosure commissions set up, then undoubtedly King Charles I is the one English monarch of outstanding importance as an agrarian reformer. There's another book too, which is E. Gonner, which was published, I mean, I managed to get hold of this, it was published in 1912, which says in 1633, this is just literally only 10 years or so before the Civil War broke out, we found a proposal that the enclosures made since James I should be thrown back. Now, by saying thrown back, that means that the people should be allowed back into their homes who'd been evicted. And thrown back into arable on pain of forfeiture, save such as be compounded for. The suggestion was not lost sight of, and from 1635 to 38, fines were levied in respect of depopulations in several counties. Now, I mean, the thing is, depopulation was a serious matter in those days, because what was happening was lots and lots of people were destitute and had nowhere to live. So, you know, this was getting back to the king, and he decided to do something about it.
I mean, we're often told the church is a very powerful institution, and particularly they expressed sort of moral surprise, if you like, at the idea of privatising land. So, you know, presumably they must have been sticking up for anti-enclosure. What sort of anti-enclosure movements were there, and who were they supported by?
Well, this really was just something quite... It was actually quite a small movement, because the big landowners were arguing that, you know, the agricultural revolution, which took place from 1700 to 1800, just after all this, that all of the... potential increases in agriculture, or the improvements in agriculture, would benefit the country as a whole. But what happened was it really divided people between the people who had land and the people who hadn't, whereas before it had been much more egalitarian society.
What have you discovered about how this impacted Bristol?
Well, the Civil War in Bristol was quite an interesting... I mean, Bristol tended to try and stay out as much as it could from the Civil War action and kept swapping its allegiance between the King and Parliament, depending on who it felt most threatened by. So... at the end of the Civil War, Cromwell was really actually quite worried about Bristol. He was frightened, if you might say, about the city, because he felt that it was one of the most difficult, dicey cities that he'd had to deal with through the whole war. So that was one of the reasons.
What did he do?
So that was one of the reasons why we don't have any remains of Bristol Castle, because he sent his explosives expert to destroy the castle to make sure that if there was any kind of rumblings after the Civil War of discontent, that there would be nowhere to defend in Bristol.
Okay, and briefly just sort of finish off, I mean, how do you feel land privatisation is a continuing issue today? Because you mentioned that at the start.
It's just places like Cabot Circus, isn't it? And the galleries. These places used to be public, you know, public streets. The actual streets are now not public anymore. They're privatised.
And
they're
that affect policing?
Well, it does, yeah. They're policed by private security. So the privatisation is still going on, and people would argue, who are genetic campaigners as well, that there are also attempts to privatise our genes, privatise genetic material from seeds and this kind of thing. So privatisation is still on the roll, and just need to be aware that the privatisation of land is one of the places it started.
Okay, well, if you're interested in the issues discussed here with my good friend Tony Gosling, there are several good books. I can recommend Christopher Hill's book, The World Turned Upside Down, which is about the levellers and diggers in the 17th century English Civil War. The book This Land Is Our Land by Marion Shord looks at the history of land privatisation or enclosure in Britain. I'll just spell Shord for you. It's Shoard. And finally, the Wordsworth Dictionary of British History by the Professor of Modern History at the University of St Andrews in Scotland. Tony says it does have a lot in it that many of the other official British history books leave out. So just repeat that, is the Wordsworth Dictionary of British History. Well, Tony Gosling, thank you very much, and I'm sure we'll return to the subject in the coming weeks.
Thanks, John.
Well, as ever, the topical eye of the Bard of Windmill Hill has been roving the news and roving the TV and see what's going on. Hello.
Hello, John.
Well, what have you got on for us this week, Trevor?
I haven't. We're not doing the news this week. We're doing something different.
Ah.
Philosophy.
Oh.
Yeah. It's an ode to caution.
Okay.
It's the early worm that can find itself eaten. For a forward thinker can often be beaten. Precocious children can quickly run out of steam, and their excess of babble can make people scream. There's a lot to be said for the well-trodden track. At least you can always find your way back. To go boldly treading where nobody has been can lead you to problems that you have not foreseen. If some stranger needs help as you pass through your day, I recommend you pretend you don't grasp what they say. It is best to keep going and not be drawn in, as the sin of omission's not really a sin. Some say that ambition is our spiritual fuel, but exhibiting keenness is not very cool. It is best fear to tread where the others won't go, and to stay safe indoors when it's starting to snow. The philosophical message says caution is best, and to put faith in nothing that's not passed a test. Though I know this may seem like a cowardly stance, trying hard may not kill you, but why take a chance?
Oh, well, for a minute there, I thought that was going to be an advert for the Samaritans there, you know, somewhere in the middle of that poem. Well, thank you very much, the Bard of Windmill Hill. And as ever, you're always too modest to mention the fact that you have a book published. You're a published poet. Tell us about your book, and where can we find it?
You could find it in Waterstones, or track me down come along to the cabaret.
Come along to the cabaret.
To the cabaret on the 9th and 10th of next month.
The Lansdowne Cabaret, Spring
the
Spectacular.
The Lansdowne, famous Spring Spectacular.
Magic, circus, Lansdowne poetry. Cabaret.
Entertainment on all fronts for only £7.
Okay.
Do you want to hear my... Should I do my little... advertising jingle?
Yes,
you want
please.
An advertising jingle?
Yes, we like jingles.
Okay.
Love them.
It's a bit long for us as jingles go, but anyway.
Okay.
When you're feeling indecisive, when you're neither out nor in, when your world appears derisive, when you feel that you can't win, when your vocal cords are tongue-tied, when you've nothing left to say, when you're sitting on the outside and no one has come out to play, do not dwell on your dilemmas. Do not think, what use is this? Forget about those passing tremors. Consider my hypothesis. We are enriched by entertainment that sees life in a different mode. It makes us ponder our arrangement as we meander our life's road. Our circus is an inspiration. Perhaps you've seen us in the news. Our music is a sound sensation to medicate recession blues. Jokey stand-ups, mock pretensions about the things we do and see. Poets offer new dimensions as versatile as verse can be. Magicians are a source of wonder, tricks to amuse you and amaze. So missing out would be a blunder. The cabaret is set to blaze! Yeah!
And all from memory, how about that? Where can people buy tickets?
They can phone me.
Yeah.
On 0117 966 5514 and make a reservation.
Okay, and the date once again?
The date 9th and 10th.
Mm-hmm.
Friday, Saturday night at the Lansdowne Pub, Clifton Road.
Okay.
8:30 start.
Okay.
But get hold of a ticket or make a reservation.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Trevor Carter. And your book, available in Waterstones, is called what?
It's called Diamonds in the Desert.
Diamonds in the Desert by Trevor Carter.
Thank you, John.
Thank you. Well, I note with approval that our resident Watson, Mr. Man, Mr. Jeff Sparks, has got his Skindred t-shirt on today. Hello.
Hello, John. Good evening. This is your Watson guide from Dialect Radio. kicking off with Thursday, 1st of April, and the Street Dogs would be performing with support from Girl Fixer, Welt, Valdez and Criminal Mind at the Croft in Stoopscroft, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £11 in advance. On to Friday, 2nd of April, Racehorses will be performing with support from Kid Adrift at the Louisiana in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £6 in advance. On to Song of the Week and our feature Motorhead. This group formed in London in 1975 and to date have released 19 studio albums and 5 live albums. This is the track Runaround Man from the album Motorizer, which was released in 2008. Motorhead with Runaround Man from the album Motorizer. They have a new studio album out this year and will be going on a UK tour in November to celebrate their 35th anniversary. For more information, you can check out www.imotorhead.com. Moving into Saturday, 3rd of April, and Limehouse Lizzie will be performing at the Fleece in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £10.50 in advance. Also on 3rd of April, the Bolsheviks will be performing with support from Los Conios and the Lone Sharks at the Tunnels in Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £7 in advance. Again on 3rd of April, Martin Simpson will be performing at the Folk House in Park Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £12 in advance. Finally, on Sunday, 4th of April, Discharge, GBH, 999, Goldblade, Rainman Suite, Dragster, Spanner and Noise Agent will be performing at the Beer Keller in All Saints Street, Bristol. Doors open at 3 p.m. and tickets are £19.50 in advance. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks, Jeff. Also, a little heads up. I went to see a band by accident, really, called Los Mondo Bongo, who's a Clash tribute made up of some of his old backing band, no less. Bassist from Simple Minds, guitarist from Gary Newman's band and such and such. And they were very good. They were excellent. They're pretty much the best Clash tributes I think you'd like to see. And playing at the Thekla in April. Can't remember the exact date, but if you check it out on the internet and you look at their MySpace, you will find the date. Los Mondo Bongo. Well, time's up. That's all for this week's show. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, as well as hearing it on the radio. We're produced by volunteers, all for free, and broadcast on Bristol Community FM across Bristol at 12 noon every Sunday. BCFM is, of course, 93.2. If you're on broadband internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or download our podcast from iTunes. Put in Dialect Radio on the iTunes site, you'll find us. We're also on Twitter as Dialect Radio. You can also find us at bristol.indymedia.org every Friday morning. That's Indymedia with a Y. Or if you're outside Bristol, you can also listen to BCFM over the internet on bcfm.org.uk. Thanks to our studio guests for their time and coming in, Helen Harrison, Junior Saunders, Ralph Hoyt, reporters about Anthea and Tony, of course. And Tony Gosling told us about English history. Excellent, hear more of that. Studio production this week was by Andy Gordon, formerly the man with no name, and the producer called Tony Gosling. Thank you very much to Trevor Carter and Jeff Sparks for the contributions. And just to remind you, Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production. That means any of you out there listening to us can contribute. So if you'd like to, either in reporting or engineering, or even if you just want to come along and watch the show being recorded, then feel free to contact Volunteering Bristol. You can contact them on 0117 989 7733. Or you can find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm John Peters Cole. Wishing you a very good week. From all the team in the Queen's Square Studio, Bristol City Centre. Thanks for your company, and until next week, goodbye.